This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Israeli forces kill at least five Palestinians in Kidan raids on several locations in the occupied West Bank. Iraq's influential Shia cleric Muqtada Assad slams as a terrorist Zionist gathering a conference held in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region on normalizing ties with Israel. And polls open in Germany's general election that looks too close to call, with a strong challenge to retiring Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservatives. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Israeli forces say they have killed at least five Palestinians overnight in the occupied West Bank. Two Palestinians were killed during an Israeli raid on Beit Anan, a neighborhood northwest of Al-Quds. Two more were shot dead in the city of Jenin, while one Palestinian succumbed to his wounds in hospital. There has been no word from Palestinian sources on the casualty figures. However, reports indicate clashes erupted in the occupied territories after regime forces carried out pre-dawn raids in at least four West Bank towns. The latest Israeli attacks come as anger runs high among Palestinians for weeks over Israel's continued settlement activities and its planned eviction of families from their ancestral homes. The Kurdistan Regional Government says a conference on normalizing ties with Israel held in Iraq's Erbil was neither authorized nor approved by local officials. The KRG said the issues discussed in the conference do not reflect the views and policies of the Kurdistan region. It also pledged to take measures to discover how the meeting was held. Earlier, prominent Iraqi figures, including the country's president and prime minister, slammed the conference as illegal. Separately, senior cleric and political leader Ammar al-Hakim reacted to the conference, calling the Palestinian cause the most important issue for Arab and Muslim nations. Influential Shia cleric Muqtada Assad also decried the meeting.
Erbil must prevent such terrorist Zionist gatherings. Otherwise, the Iraqi government must treat all the participants of such conferences as criminals and arrest them. If Erbil does not prevent such meetings, we will take actions that we are religiously, intellectually, and nationally responsible for.
The leader of Iraq's Asaib Ahl al-Haq movement also said the meeting is against Iraqi law and violates human and national principles. Qais al-Khazali said the resistance movement will not keep quiet against, quote, such a great betrayal. other Iraqi groups, including Fatah Alliance, Popular Mobilization Units, and Kataib Hezbollah, also decried the conference. On Friday, 300 people gathered in the city of Erbil to demand the normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel. The event was organized by a U.S. think tank. Muslim pilgrims are marching toward Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arba'in. The pilgrims are arriving in the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September the 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. It has allowed only 40,000 foreign visitors into the country, many of them Iranians. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with a tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Moving on, Iran says it will judge the United States by its acts, not words, and its willingness to return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
We have made it clear that we will judge Americans by their practical behavior, and their conflicting messages relayed to us through the media or diplomatic channels will not contribute to our decision-making.
Amir Abdullahian made the comments as he was wrapping up a five-day trip to New York to attend the UN General Assembly. The top diplomat said Iran's conditions for returning to the talks in Vienna to revive the accord was a hot topic at his meetings. Amir Abdullahian said he discussed the issue in details with his French, German, and British counterparts, as well as the EU foreign policy chief. Iran has already blasted the U.S. for failing to take a serious step to resume compliance with the pact it unilaterally left 3 years ago. Tehran says it wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner before rejoining the accord. Iran and Venezuela have reportedly struck an agreement to swap oil for condensates amid U.S. sanctions on both countries. According to Reuters, the deal would last for 6 months but could be extended. Under the agreement, Venezuela's oil company, PDVSA, will receive condensates to dilute its oil. In return, the National Iranian Oil Company will get shipments of Venezuelan heavy oil that it can market in Asia. A U.S. Treasury spokesperson said the department was, quote, concerned about reports of the swap contract. The official said Washington would continue to enforce its sanctions regimes on both Tehran and Caracas. Germans are heading to the polls in a knife-edge national election to pick a successor to Chancellor Angela Merkel after 16 years in power. More than 60 million people are eligible to cast their ballots to choose members of the lower house of the federal parliament, the Bundestag. The election is too tight to call. The center-left Social Democrats, or SPD, are posing a tough challenge to Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party. The retiring chancellor has urged voters to support Armin Laschet to shape the country's future. 60-year-old Laschet is running against Olaf Scholz of the SPD. Laschet has warned the SPD-led alliance would destabilize Europe with its plans. Scholz, 63, has said he is fighting for, quote, a major change in Germany. The president of the British Automobile Association says panic buying rather than shortages is causing queues at UK petrol stations. Edmund King said the problem should pass in a matter of days if drivers just stick to filling up when they need to. He said there is plenty of fuel at source and that a shortage of lorry drivers was only a localized problem earlier in the week. On Saturday, panic buying continued throughout Britain's petrol stations. Worker shortages are a growing problem in Britain, which had a record 1 million job vacancies between June and August. Now, in a U-turn on its post-Brexit immigration policy, Britain has decided to issue over 10,000 temporary work visas to lorry drivers and poultry workers to ease chronic staff shortages.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blamed the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there is no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it's looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
Russia has called on the United States to stop imposing its development model on other nations.
President Biden has recently announced the rejection of military methods used to, as he put it, remake other countries. We expect the U.S. to take one step further and reject any other methods of imposing their development model on others, not only military ones.
Sergei Lavrov made the remarks during his speech to the United Nations General Assembly. Lavrov highlighted his country's role in Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. He said Moscow has been contributing to stabilizing the situation in Syria within the framework of the Astana process and has been working with all Libyan parties to implement political reforms. On Afghanistan's crisis, Lavrov stressed that Russia has been constructively engaged in the formation or promotion, I should say, of an Afghan resolution. He said recognizing the Taliban is not currently under consideration.
We don't have any information about anybody having turned to us for the accreditation. There is an ambassador working in Moscow who was appointed by the previous government, and the question of international recognition of the Taliban at the present juncture is not on the table. We will proceed from that premise if we receive a request for the appointment of a new ambassador.
The remarks come after the Taliban named a UN envoy setting up a showdown over Afghanistan's seat at the world body. Taliban Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi on Monday nominated the group's spokesman, Suhail Shaheen, as Afghanistan's UN ambassador. Ghulam Ishaqzai, the current UN ambassador who represents Afghanistan's ousted government, has also asked to renew his UN accreditation. The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan last month. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill to provide $1 billion in additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The overwhelming bipartisan support for the motion comes at a time when the U.S. government is facing a shutdown due to disagreements between the two political camps over the country's spending limit.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power. And furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid.
The newly passed $1 billion budget comes on top of the United States' regular funding for Israel's missile system. Washington provides the regime with $3.8 billion of military assistance annually. Some $500 million of the figure goes to Israel's missile systems. The latest flare-up of conflict between Israel and the Palestinian resistance once again proved that the astronomical funding will not protect the regime against missiles launched from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government's spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
That does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
As the Delta variant continues to spread in the state and local officials enforce uneven safety measures in schools across the U.S., several states are reporting that children are accounting for more COVID-19 cases than ever, with both hospitalizations and deaths on the rise. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading COVID-19 Cases and Deaths Rising Among Children Across the United States of America. Stay tuned for more. The Delta variant continues to spread, and state and local officials enforce uneven safety measures in schools across the United States of America. Several states are reporting that children are accounting for more COVID-19 cases than ever, with both hospitalizations and deaths on the rise. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported recently that residents under age 18 now account for more cases than any other age group, with 1,126 cases currently affecting children. In Oregon, public health officials said children aged 9 and younger are now more likely to test positive for the coronavirus than adults over age 60, a troubling new milestone for the pandemic in the state. The state's rising cases are on track with a report that the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, and the Children's Hospital Association released recently, which showed nearly 1 million children have tested positive for COVID-19 in the past month, following a return to in-person learning school districts across the U.S. After declining in early summer, child cases have increased exponentially with over 925,000 cases in the past 4 weeks, the report said. Pediatric cases reported recently represented an increase of 480% over children's cases that were reported in mid-July, according to Fortune. Hospitalizations of children, while rare across the country, are also on the rise, with children now making up between 1.6% and 4.2% of COVID-19 hospitalizations in the 24 states that submitted data for the AAP report. In Oregon, where around 75% of adults are at least partially vaccinated, officials did not express major concerns about widespread severe illness in children. So far in the state, 2 children, both infants, have died of COVID-19 since the pandemic began 18 months ago. In states with low vaccination rates, hospitals are reporting that pediatric intensive care units have become overwhelmed in recent weeks. In Louisiana, 2 children have died of the disease in under a week, bringing the total number of fatalities among children to 16 in the state. 7 of those deaths have come in the last 3 months. Dr. Mark Klein, physician-in-chief at Children's Hospital New Orleans, expressed outrage earlier this week at the rise in children's deaths. Children are being put at risk of serious illness and death by unvaccinated adults, said Klein, adding, "Is there an acceptable pediatric body count? I think not." Public health experts agree pediatric cases are most likely in areas where fewer eligible people are vaccinated. Currently, COVID-19 vaccines are available for most people over the age of 12. Louisiana has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, with 51% of residents 12 and over at least partially vaccinated. The best way to protect kids that can't be vaccinated is to have all the adults around them vaccinated. Dr. Elisa Hayes Bacon, a medical director at Dornbecker Children's Hospital, told The Oregonian recently. Other methods of protecting children, including adherence to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention CDC guidance, calling for universal masking in schools, is being applied unevenly. As of September 14th, nearly 60% of statewide cases in Georgia were in schools. Republican Governor Brian Kemp has refused to mandate public health measures. Face coverings are also optional in schools in Colorado, where school cases nearly doubled over just 7 days last week. In Denver schools, 220 school children were quarantined after 35 staff members and 170 students tested positive. The risk to children right now is higher than it's ever been during the pandemic because of the Delta variant being more transmissible, Rachel Herlini, the state epidemiologist for Colorado, told Bloomberg. Janet Woodcock, acting FDA commissioner, and Peter Marks, the director of the agency's Center for Biology's Evaluation and Research, in a statement recently said, conducting clinical trials to determine an appropriate vaccine dose in children requires additional work over that done in the adults' studies, including ensuring that the vaccine dosage and formulation strength used is the appropriate one from the perspective of safety and generating an immune response. Meanwhile, the AAP report recently noted that while it appears that severe illness due to COVID-19 is uncommon among children, there is an urgent need to collect more data on longer-term impacts of pandemic on children, including ways the virus may harm the long-term physical health of infected children, as well as its emotional and mental health effects.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The safe. That's what the Israelis call the maximum security prison in Gilboa. Well, it doesn't seem like much of a safe anymore. Six Palestinian men have escaped from there in what is effectively the most notorious jailbreak of the last 20 years. And while Israelis have launched a giant manhunt trying to clear up the embarrassment, Palestinians have been celebrating the escape as an act of defiance against the occupation and a much-needed boost of morale. So how did they do it, you ask? How did six men tunnel out of an Israeli maximum security prison? Well, they did it using a spoon, of course. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In the early hours of Monday morning on September 6th, a daring prison escape took place in cell number 5, wing 2 of the Israeli maximum security prison in Gilboa. Nicknamed The Safe, six Palestinian men broke out of their prison cell through a hole under the shower using a tunnel that they had dug with a rusty spoon. Gilboa Prison was built back in 2004 and sits 6 kilometers away from the West Bank and just 16 kilometers from the Jordanian border. This is where Palestinians are sent to serve long and even life sentences. Considered one of the occupation's toughest prisons, the cells do not even have windows. The escapees dug a tunnel around 22 meters long for several months before finally escaping on September 6th at around 1 a.m. The prison didn't even know there had been an escape until locals reported seeing something suspicious to the occupation authorities, who then informed the prison. And by the time they did a head count and realized six prisoners were missing, 3 hours had already passed. Now, the six men who escaped are Mahmoud Arida, incarcerated since 1996, life in prison; Muhammad Arida, incarcerated since 2002, life in prison; Ayhan Kamenji, incarcerated since 2006, life in prison; Yaqub Qadri, incarcerated since 2003, life in prison; Zakaria Zubaydi, in prison since 2019, awaiting trial; Munad al-Nufayat, incarcerated since 2019, without charge. Now, five of the men are members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Meanwhile, Zakaria Zubaydi, perhaps the most famous of the six, was a former commander of the Al-Aqsa Marches Brigade and a very prominent figure in the Palestinian resistance. His mother was killed by an Israeli sniper, as was his brother, and their home demolished three times by the Israelis. On the morning of the escape, videos emerged showing the Israeli prison guards examining the tunnel which the prisoners had dug. And the fact that six Palestinian resistance fighters had outsmarted one of the Israelis' most highly secured prisons with literally a spoon drew laughter and mockery online as people compared the prison break to movies like Shawshank Redemption and flooded the internet with memes. Now, in Western movies and media, the Israelis always love to portray themselves as extremely intelligent and competent, perpetuating this myth that they are smarter than everyone else and they are the best in technology and security. Well, it turns out all that was needed to defeat one of their maximum security prisons were six determined Palestinians and one spoon, a rusty spoon, which they hid behind a poster, hence the comparisons to Shawshank. Not only that, but the men also managed to evade 40 guards, three watchtowers, two walls, barbed wires, security cameras, and a pack of sniffer dogs. The Israelis, of course, didn't find the jokes very funny and launched a manhunt instead in an attempt to capture the men. And when news of the escape broke, many towns and cities in Palestine erupted in celebration with people handing out sweets in the street. Both Hamas and Fatah celebrated the escape, calling on Palestinians to protect and aid the escapees. Most of the men actually come from Jenin, which is located not too far from the prison. And residents of their hometown erupted in celebration, as did Palestinians in Gaza, Jerusalem, the West Bank, and all over, heralding the six as heroes. Protests were also held in solidarity with those who are still incarcerated after Israel, in response, imposed punitive measures such as moving prisoners of Islamic Jihad into different prisons, closing the prisoner shop which sells basic necessities. The Israelis also limited the number of prisoners allowed in the yard at any given time and reduced the time they're allowed to spend outside to just 1 hour a day. Now, this whole incident was such an embarrassment for the Israelis, they even began arresting the family members of the escaped men as a form of collective punishment, detaining at least seven family members. And this reminds us of last year when the Israelis killed Iyad Halla, a 32-year-old Palestinian man. He was autistic, and after the Israeli forces killed him in cold blood, they raided his parents' house in an attempt to find something incriminating and intimidate his family. Meanwhile, the Israeli media has begun offering a myriad of responses as to why this escape happened. First, they say that the blueprints for the prison were posted online by the architecture firm that built the prison. That firm's website is subsequently gone offline. Israeli media also reported that perhaps one of the guards had fallen asleep, or that the prisoners maybe had someone helping them on the inside or the outside. All these wild explanations, except the very obvious one, that they had simply been outsmarted and defeated by the six freedom fighters. Now, despite the success of the escape and finally being free and able to breathe in the fresh air of Palestine again, this freedom was to be short-lived, unfortunately. A few days later, on the night of September 10th, four of the escaped men were captured by Israeli forces just a few hours apart. Yaqub Khadri and Mahmoud Arida were detained just a few hours later near the town of Shibli Amel Ghanam. And in the early morning hours of September 19th, the last two men, Kamamji and Nufayat, were detained by Israeli forces near their hometown of Jenin. And of course, one of the first things the occupation does is post photographs of the men in handcuffs on social media in order to show off and posture, and more importantly, before they've been beaten and tortured. For they surely wouldn't post those pictures, would they? And while the Israeli media calls the men terrorists, it's quite ironic, given that Zakaria Zubaydi has been waiting 2 years for a trial, and Munad al-Nufayat hasn't even been charged with the crime, let alone convicted. And of course, the other four are only terrorists in the eyes of the occupying power because they dared to resist, and they surely didn't receive fair trials. Although there were rumors online and in the Israeli media that the captured men had been turned in to the occupation forces by other Palestinians, this is false. This claim was refuted by one of the escapees, Mohammed Larida, who insisted that no one had reported them or turned them in. It was simply bad luck, as they were spotted by an Israeli patrol. The escapees never interacted with anyone, never asked for assistance, precisely to avoid the Israelis exacting revenge on others. Indeed, it was widely feared that were the men to be recaptured, they would face severe punishment at the hands of the Israelis. And this, unfortunately, proved to be true. A photograph of Zakariah Zubeidi shows his face completely swollen from the beatings after being arrested. Zakariah was beaten and tortured so badly that he had to be transferred to a hospital, to the intensive care unit. His brother has told the media that it is very difficult to get any news or updates about his health, as this is being kept secret by the Israelis. Later on, the occupation court decided to extend the detention of the four escapees who had been recaptured and even blocked them from meeting with their lawyers, making it difficult to check on their health and well-being. Zakaria's defense lawyer, Avidor Feldman, told the Associated Press that Zakariah was taken to hospital and given painkillers because of fractures to his jaw and two of his ribs after being beaten up during arrest. Muhammad Arida, who was captured alongside Zakariah, was also severely beaten during arrest before being taken to a police station and stripped naked for interrogation. As of now, the four escapees are being held by the Shin Bet in another prison and put through excruciating interrogations that last all day. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me on the program from Jerusalem is Palestinian politician, activist, and scholar Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. She served as an official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, and until last year, as a senior member of the PLO Executive Committee. She held several posts within the Palestinian Authority, the Arab League, as well as the PLO. As an activist, she founded several bodies and institutions dedicated to Palestinian self-determination, such as the Independent Commission for Human Rights. Dr. Ashrawi, it's an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you, Richard.
Doctor, can I just begin perhaps a bit more broadly with the West now marking the anniversary of the so-called Abraham Accords? What do you make of that? And what are your thoughts on the current state of the resistance? I mean, do you think that in the last month since Al-Aqsa and everything that's happened since, do you believe that the resistance is headed in the right direction?
Yeah, well, the celebration of Abraham Accords is really a very cynical manipulation of a very bad situation in which the conflict is perpetuated with the complicity and collusion of some Arab countries or some Arab regimes that were either blackmailed or bribed into normalizing with Israel, which means normalizing the occupation and injustice and lawlessness and so on. That's another issue we can talk about for a long time. Palestinian resistance is ongoing. It has never stopped. The question is, what shape does it take? What expression does it adopt? It adopts many shapes, many expressions, and basically it is firmly embedded in the Palestinian people's refusal to surrender.
And the recent escape by the six men from Gilboa, what does that mean particularly for the resistance? Why is this escape so important in its timing, its scale, and its nature, and how does it play into everything that we just talked about?
The most significant aspect of this latest phase is, of course, the expression of total unity among the younger generation of all Palestinians everywhere. Well, the six liberated or self-liberated prisoners have captured the imagination of the Palestinian people, and actually of the world, of people of conscience. These are Palestinians unjustly imprisoned in many cases and unlawfully kept within prisons in Israel and judged by a military court of the occupation. So, and kept in one of the most secure prisons in Israel, Gilboa, and they managed persistently and in a in an amazing way to dig this tunnel, to be able to find their way to freedom. It gave the Palestinians a sense of hope, a boost of morale, that even Israel's most militarily secured location is not immune to the Palestinian spirit and yearning to be free. This was the most important message. And all the Palestinian people united in defending them, supporting them, and expressing a sense of solidarity and appreciation, while expressing also our yearning to be free. There are different types of activity, of captivity, but as you know, all of Palestine is being held captive by Israel.
You know, we saw the Israeli media say that the prison's blueprints were left online by the architecture firm that built the prison. They said there were also problems with the plumbing system that were exploited. They even suggested that one of the guards simply fell asleep or was working with the prisoners. I mean, we've heard a whole host of reasons from the Israelis. Do you think that perhaps they're just coming up with excuses to try and cover up their embarrassment?
Of course. Yeah, this is typical. They're always trying to diminish the achievements of Palestine and the Palestinian people. They're always trying to say, well, something went wrong, or one person is responsible, or whatever. But the issue is that there is this dedication, there is this total commitment to achieving their freedom, to seeing their families, to, as one person said, 5 days smelling the fresh air of Palestine, of looking at Palestine, of eating some of the fruits and so on, is equal to a lifetime in prison. This is the kind of spirit, undefeated spirit, of the Palestinian people. And this is something that is not consistent with the Israeli narrative and with the Israeli misrepresentation of the Palestinians. As you know, historically, Israel always labeled all Palestinians as terrorists. And so it goes on and on and on. They never say Palestinian unless they add the term terrorist to it. So the denial of the humanity, the denial of the spirit, the denial of the dedication of the real human nature of the Palestinian people and narrative, this now is not so credible, given the fact that reality is coming out, that people have a chance to look at what's happening, to address the Palestinians directly, to utilize social media and other means in order to debunk the myths and expose the lies of Israel.
Hamas announced that there will be no prisoner exchanges in the future with the Israelis unless they include the 6 men from Gilboa, essentially that they will be free in any case. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that really encouraged Palestinian people, because these 6 deserve to be free. And we believe all Palestinians deserve to be free, that all Palestinian political prisoners and Israeli prisons are being held unlawfully and unjustly. But in any prisoner exchange, certainly. They, as well as others like Marwan Barghouti and Hamad Saadat and others, have to be released. So the fact is that they paid the price of their captivity, so to speak, and they showed the world how they can break the walls of their prison, how they can defy the conditions of their injustice. So certainly, yes, they should be at the top of the list.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you, the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar reported from an unnamed source that the Palestinian Authority had agreed to help the Israelis catch the men in exchange for easing of prison conditions. Do you think this report is credible, and what are your thoughts on it?
No, I would like to check the source, frankly speaking. I don't know who told this to Allah, but it has to be credible, because I don't believe that there's any Palestinian who will betray these people, whether the leadership or among the people. And everybody, including the government and the presidency, everybody expressed solidarity with the prisoners, with the liberated prisoners, with those still in prison, and they maintained their commitment to them. So I don't think that anybody would betray them in any way, no.
Right. I also wasn't sure if it's an attempt to sow discord, as they were also putting other stories out and so on.
Of course. They attempted to say that they were handed over or betrayed by other Palestinians in villages and so on. So, as usual, the source of information should never be Israel.
why is it important for people to understand, to acknowledge that the men who the self-liberated men, you know, they're freedom fighters, they're resistance fighters, not just morally, ethically, but indeed legally under international law?
It is important because, as I said, Israel has been trying to distort and malign the Palestinian struggle as a whole and the Palestinian people, including individuals and freedom fighters and so on. Look, Israel has arrested over 1 million people since 1967 only, Palestinians, and has killed over 75,000 Palestinians. Does that mean Israel has found a nation of terrorists? Does it mean that Israel has a system of justice for its people under its occupation and held in captivity? Does it mean that the Israeli military courts and the Israeli laws and occupiers' laws and so on hand out justice to the Palestinian people? These are occupiers who are using every possible means, including utter lawlessness and violence, against a captive population. And then they give themselves the right to arrest, to detain, to kill, extrajudicial killings, and so on, and to brand everybody who defies its oppression and occupation as a terrorist. So placing things in context, contextualizing the reality of these prisoners or self-liberating. Actually, people remain free inside, even though you are held in captivity. So to try to malign them and to try to justify why they're there and to try once again, I mean, the way they were treated when they were caught, it's just horrendous. The way they were beaten, the way they were insulted and abused and so on, it's horrific. But this is the nature of Israeli occupation and a settler colonial regime that is based on pure, unadulterated racism. Hmm? Racism, Islamophobia, denial of the humanity of the other, using any means of control in order to be able to maintain a stronghold and to steal the land and resources, as well as the narrative and reality and identity of the Palestinian people.
One of the prisoners, Zakaria Zubaydi, we heard that he's been you know, treated so badly, beaten up so badly by the Israelis that he was sent to the intensive care unit. And there's a media blackout on his health condition. Do we have any news on that front about how he's doing, or is this blackout still in place?
I think his lawyer came out and talked about how he was beaten up and yes. Broken bones and his face and his head was. So news is coming out, and it comes through Palestinian lawyers or people who are able to reach him, and they're not many. I think only one person was able to reach him. But when you look at the photos of his arrest and the ways in which they tried to cover him up so that he won't be seen, the army, the soldiers were surrounding him, but you could see his face, and they said his face, his head. And of course he had previous injuries, so they targeted these injuries in the legs and so on. And the whole history of Zakaria Zubaydi, the way they killed his mother by an Israeli sniper, killed his father, arrested and killed many of his siblings and so on. It's just a history of tragedies, a history of willful, deliberate cruelty and murder, actually. And he hasn't been tried, by the way. He has been held for years, because when you don't have evidence, this administrative detention is just horrific. They don't have evidence, they just want to punish somebody for no reason. It is part of the Israeli mindset and the occupation. And so the story of Zakaria must be told and must be understood in its context. And the film that was made, Arna's Children, talks about a bit of his history. But at the same time, his family and his extended family and community and Jenin and the refugee camp in Jenin, as well as all of Palestine, it encapsulates this story of Zakaria, encapsulates the most horrific injustices imposed on the Palestinian people and must be seen, must be heard, must be read in order to understand the true nature of this settler colonial regime and this apartheid system in Palestine.
And it's a very heartbreaking story. And just as a last question, Doctor, what would you like to see from the movement in general? You mentioned unity among Palestinians everywhere, and that's a beautiful thing. What would you like to see going forward from the resistance movement towards the liberation of Palestine?
Yeah, well, liberation is a right. I always say we all have the right to live in freedom and dignity on our own land. We have the right to exercise the fullness of our humanity. In terms of our own struggle, I mean, the struggle continues, as you know, in different shapes and forms. Nonviolent resistance, whether it is the will to stay on the land, to me, is the most important thing. Being able to remain, to defy, not to succumb, not to be defeated in your spirit, not to abandon your rights, and not to relinquish your urge, your drive to be free, singularly and collectively. This is very important. And of course, the most important thing is to be able to withstand all these injustices and pressures, to stay on the land and to maintain your spirit and your commitment.
This escape was the largest and most successful of the last 20 years in Palestine, and therefore the Israelis want to make an example out of the six men. But the simple fact of the matter is that these men are not criminals. Remember, one of them has not even been charged with a crime, let alone convicted. And he spent 2 years in jail. But in the mainstream media, they always insist on using terms like militant or terrorist or whatever else the Israeli government wants to call Palestinians. But what is their crime? Resisting a foreign military occupation which has killed their families and taken their land? And then when they escape from prison, which is a natural human instinct, they are beaten and tortured? These men are freedom fighters by definition. Everyone has the right under international law to resist a foreign military occupation, including Palestinians. This is spelled out very clearly under international law by the United Nations, the Geneva Convention. These men, like all Palestinians, have extraordinary resilience and courage not to give up after all that they've been through. And to pull off such an escape, they not only freed themselves, but raised the morale of all and gave hope to millions of Palestinians also living under occupation. Whether the Israelis capture one or capture all six, at the end of the day, what these men did at Gilboa was a victory for the resistance front, which cannot be taken away. Regardless of the outcome, the simple fact is that these men liberated themselves from the cruel imprisonment of the occupier, and that is a victory in and of itself. The fact that they did this with a rusty spoon makes it all the more incredible. As a matter of fact, people started throwing spoons at the Israeli embassy in Washington in a show of solidarity with them. And in another show of support, Hamas recently announced that there will be no more prisoner exchanges with Israel without the six men from Gilboa. So in essence, whether the Israelis like it or not, those six men will be free one way or another. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Holy Defense, a Mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Wars, apart from destruction, carnage and pillage, are sources of various innovations in different fields. A significant part of art and literature has been formed in and after wars. A big number of poems, paintings, novels, and so on has been created about various wars in different parts of the world. The best literary works like Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, Odyssey of Homer, and War and Peace of Tolstoy have been written on the events of war and national events and myth. It should be said that epic literature shapes a big share of literature of every nation and is the mirror of lofty ideals of mankind. The 8-year war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam imposed on Iran in the 1980s upon the order of his Western and Eastern masters caused the Islamic Revolution of Iran to enter a new phase and set the ground for creation of the literature and poetry of the Holy Defense. The Holy Defense of the Iranian nation had taken Imam Hussein's Ashura uprising as its role model. The very mentioning of Hussein's name would inspire the Iranian combatants, and they used to recite poems and eulogies on Imam Hussein and his companions in the battlefields. An epic usually consists of two parts. The first part is the creation of the epic in the battlefront, and the second part is to convey the message of the epic. The second part is often fulfilled by a group of writers, poets, and artists who have just changed the weapons and continue the work of the combatants in a new form. Many novels and poems have been written on the Holy Defense, but one of the most important and bestsellers of this genre is the book Da by Sayyid Azam Husseini. The book is based on the memoirs of Sayyid Zahra Husseini and is a detailed documentary report of the days of war by a teenager girl. Da means mother in Kurdish, and the writer has chosen the name to manifest a very part of the sacrifices of the Iranian mothers, especially those in the war-torn regions during the 8-year imposed war.